It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll look at new research that shows the length of time kids have to eat their lunches affects the healthiness of what they eat and how much they throw away.
First, we're hearing more news this week about the state's main job creation agency. According to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation's annual report, the agency handed out significantly more money in economic development awards than last year, but those awards are expected to produce fewer jobs and millions less in capital investment.
This news comes as politicians in the state continue to argue about the future of WEDEC. Democrats say scrap it and start over, but others worry that doing so could lead to some of the same problems that plagued WEDEC after its creation.
Matt DeFore joins us with the details. He's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me back.
Well, last year WEDEC gave out more money in economic development awards than in previous years. How did that come to be? What accounts for the increase?
Right. There was about a $90 million increase from about $157 million in 2014 to about $246 million in 2015. And the main driver of that increase was a historic rehabilitation tax credit that the legislature approved in 2013. Now, when the legislature adopted it, it wasn't really clear what kind of impact this expanded tax credit would have on, you know, how many people would claim it, how much it would cost. But it turned out, you know, so that when they budgeted for it, they were expecting it to be about $2 million a year. But after the program started, this was a couple of years ago, WEDEC announced it had to put a moratorium on the program because there was so much demand that was unexpected. So in the first year, they ended up putting out about $3 million in awards for this rehabilitation tax credit. But in the second year, it went up to like about $80 million. So it was a huge increase. That is a big part of the reason why the total awards went up. But if you take that out, and there are no jobs attached to any of that, mm-hmm. If you take that out, you still see about a $13.5 million increase and almost a 6,000 decline in the number of jobs that are attached to those awards.
Yeah, let's get into that. Why fewer jobs attach to these awards? Is it that maybe they're just looking at this, calculating things differently, not being as rosy and optimistic as they used to be when it came to the job creation side?
Well, this isn't about optimism as much as what they're actually negotiating with the companies as to, you know, what they're tying these awards, these tax credits, these loans, these grants. They have contracts with these companies saying, if you do this, you will get, you know, if you do X, you will get Y. And the issue here is that, and certainly Democrats are raising questions about this, is that if the state is giving out more money to, or making more money available to companies, you'd think as a job creation agency, they would then be creating more jobs. But that's not what we're seeing in these numbers.
Talking to Matt DeFore from the Wisconsin State Journal about some of the latest news on Wisconsin's Economic Development Corporation. So what does WEDEC say? How do they account for more money, often in the form of tax credits, and fewer jobs as a result?
Well, the official answer that they gave me yesterday was that in 2014, when there were awards that gave out about 32,689 jobs, that's how many jobs were supposed to be created or retained. Again, that's, you know, a combination of two things. In 2014, they had three major projects of more than $100 million. I think it was Amazon, Meijer, and Agripor. These are three of, in the whole history of, five-year history of WEDEC, they've had five projects in which there was going to be more than $100 million in capital investment, and so that happened in 2014. They also had an economic development tax credit in 2014 that declined into 2015. And what they said there was that there was there's a manufacturing and agriculture tax credit that the legislature approved, which does not go through WEDC. That's done through the Department of Revenue, and they're saying that because companies are taking advantage of that tax credit, there's less demand for the economic development tax credit, and so they gave out less of that. I'm not sure, though, that fully explains why, again, the number of dollars handed out went down while the number of jobs or while the number of dollars went up while the number of jobs went down.
And you mentioned Democrats raising this as a part of a laundry list now of issues that they're criticizing Wiedek for. Is this more fuel for the fire to get rid of Wiedek and replace it with something else, as some Democratic lawmakers want to do?
Right. Well, the Democrats have said that the Wiedek brand is broken. We'll hear more about this on Thursday when they're supposed to. The Wiedek board is meeting tomorrow in Oak Creek to discuss this report and finalize it, because this is a draft, actually. And so there'll be, I'm sure there'll be discussion about this. And as we go forward, we'll see what the legislature does. The Republicans are hosting the first of five listening sessions on economic development, also in Oak Creek tomorrow. And so we'll see what businesses around the state are saying about this organization and what needs to be done, and if anything, to change it.
Well, as we've mentioned, a lot of the funding that we're talking about is in the form of tax credits that companies get theoretically after they meet the conditions, they hire the workers, they build the new plant. So it's not as though the state's just cutting a check right up front and then not getting results down the road.
That's right. In terms of the tax credits and the grants and the loans, they usually are tied, the tax credits for sure are tied to these job numbers that I'm talking about. It's you will do this, and then you will get the money. The issue, though, here is more about what are they negotiating with these companies in order to get these jobs that the state is looking for. The governor had this ambitious goal of creating 250,000 jobs in his first term. And so if the agency is giving out money but not getting as much bang for its buck as Representative Barca has concerns about, that's a question that people want to know, is what kind of negotiators are they if they're trying to get companies to create jobs or retain jobs, but they're not exactly getting as much out of it. I know the chairman of the WEDC board, Dan Ahrens, at a recent audit committee hearing, he talked about the idea that going forward, it might be difficult for them to guarantee that they can have companies create a net increase in jobs. This is in response to an idea that the legislature create a law saying that any deal that the WEDC negotiates has to create a net increase in jobs. And it didn't sound like the Wiedek board chairman was 100% sold on that requirement. And so I think that's all part of this concern about what direction we're headed with giving out these funds to companies in exchange for jobs.
Matt, as we wrap up, given rumblings from Democrats and some Republicans targeting Wiedek, are you expecting to see changes, either small tweaks or big revisions when it comes to this economic development corporation?
There have already been a lot of changes. So we'll see if, again, the governor at the beginning of the year was talking about scrapping it and merging it with another agency, and then that went away. And so it's not completely clear what they're going to do, but I know a lot of Republicans are saying, hey, there have been changes. We've changed some programs. We've reduced its funding. There's been all these policies put in place. Let's give it some breathing room and some time, and let's just continue to see how it goes.
All right. We'll be watching this, as I'm sure you will. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Matt DeFore. He's a state capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. He joins us to talk about the latest news about the state's often criticized job creation agency, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. As experts debate the causes and cures for nutritional deficits and obesity among kids today, new research shows that when kids have more time to eat their lunches, they eat healthier lunches.
Here to tell us more is Juliana Cohen. She's assistant professor in the Department of Health Sciences at Merrimack College and adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Juliana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Going in, what questions did you want to answer with your research?
We were interested in if the amount of time that students have to eat lunch impacted what they put on their tray and how much they ate at school.
And so how did you set up this research to get a sampling of what kids were actually eating and the time they had to eat it in?
What we did was, as part of a larger study, we went into six schools and we recorded all the foods that students were selecting when they got in the lunch line. We examined how much they consumed by the end of the lunch period using the gold standard, which is a plate weigh study. So we actually weighed every single item remaining on all the trays of the students participating in our study. And we also recorded the amount of time that they had to eat because we knew the start of the lunch period, we knew the end of the lunch period, and when they were leaving the lunch line, we recorded that time as well. So we were able to record the amount of seated time they had to actually eat their meal.
So you weren't starting at the clock, say, when the bell rang and they walked to the lunchroom. You were starting the clock right when they sat down with their plate of food in front of them.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the things that makes our study unique, because this wasn't what's the length of the lunch period and how that impacts consumption. We actually knew the time that they had to sit and eat their meal. And we tracked the same students over multiple days. So there might be a day where a student had a full 30 minutes to eat, and then another day when that same student might have only had 10 minutes to eat if they're at the end of the lunch line.
And so what were the variables when it came to the amount of time? What was the longest amount of time a student had to eat and the least amount of time?
So in our schools, the lunch periods range from 20 minutes to 30 minutes, but we found that some students are actually able to arrive to lunch early. So we had some students who actually had a full 33 minutes to eat their lunch, but we also found a substantial number of students that had much less than that. In fact, we found some students had as little as 10 minutes to actually eat their lunch.
Well, let's dig into the findings a little bit. What did you see?
What we found was that when students had less than 20 minutes to eat, they were less likely to even put a fruit on their tray. And in addition to that, when they had less than 20 minutes to eat, they consumed on average 13% less of their entree, 12% less of their vegetables, and 10% less of their milk compared with students who had at least 25 minutes to eat.
And when we're talking about the options available, were you looking at students who had some choice in what they ate, or were they eating maybe a standard hot lunch that everybody ate?
That's a great question. So typically in these schools, students have a couple different options. So they have a couple different entree options, a couple options for their fruits and their vegetables, and usually a choice between white and chocolate milk.
And so with the children who had less amount of time to eat, you said they were one thing that was first to go was the piece of fruit. What does that tell you?
So what that suggests to us is that when students realize they don't even have enough time to eat, it's possible they may not even bother selecting a fruit. So something like an orange where they might have to peel it themselves, they recognize there's just too much time. They don't even bother in the first place.
And the kids who had longer periods to eat their lunch, and what did their intake look like?
So they consumed significantly more of their meals, meaning that they threw out a lot less of their foods. So overall, they were consuming more of their entrees, more vegetables, more milk, and they were more likely to select a fruit.
Interesting. So looking at that study, what conclusions are you drawing about the length of lunchtime?
I think there's a couple really important points. One is that with the current debate around the school meal standards, with these healthier standards, there's concerns about food waste. And what we really need to start focusing on is how do we reduce the amount of waste in schools? And it looks like the length of the lunch period may play a really important role. So if we can focus on policies to increase the amount of time that students have to eat, or at least have minimum standards for lunch period lengths, I think that would really benefit students. Currently, there are no standards for school meals outside of what a school district may have. So there are no national standards. But we also recognize that not all schools are going to be able to increase the length of their lunch periods. So there are other options. So, for example, increasing the number of lunch lines or cashiers when they check out can help increase the speed that students can get through the lunch lines. Similarly, the automated point of sales system, that can get students faster through the lunch line, and that means they'll have more time to actually eat.
So another thing some people talk about is maybe flipping around lunch and recess, because kids might be in a hurry to get out to recess and gobble their food, whereas if they had recess first, they might relax a little more when they had to sit down to eat.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic point. So having recess before lunch may also help. Not only will it maybe help the students focus on eating their meals, but exactly as you said, then perhaps they won't be in that rush to leave the cafeteria and run out to the playground.
Now, as a nutritionist, how big a deal is this? If, say, a kid doesn't eat a piece of fruit at lunch, does it have a long-term impact?
That's a great question. And I think that if you think about it long-term, the answer is yes. Because imagine that's occurring every day throughout the entire school year. That's a lot of fruit.
So we can switch some things around, but how hard a sell do you think this is going to be to schools to try to change the way that they conduct lunches?
I think that schools really need to focus on this because the entire day is a time to learn, and that includes inside the cafeteria. Students are learning what a balanced meal looks like, how to eat a balanced meal. And in fact, these type of meals, the healthier meals, likely will help them do better in school as well. So schools should really prioritize making sure that students have enough time to eat. Some of our school districts that we work with also are very low income, meaning the majority of students rely on these school meals every single day for sometimes over half their energy intake. We need to make sure that these students are getting what they need while they're in school.
Now, you looked at the weight of the food, you looked at the food waste, but did you have a sense as a researcher whether students in general would like to have more time to eat their food?
That's a great question. So what these results suggest to us, the fact that they were eating less across the board suggests that they just genuinely did not have enough time to eat. And if we had given them more time, they would have eaten more.
Juliana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Juliana Cohen is assistant professor in the Department of Health Sciences at Merrimack College and adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She joined us to talk about her new research showing that kids who have more time to eat lunch eat healthier food and throw away less of it.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a new outreach program is highlighting the worst roads in Wisconsin. The goal is to encourage state lawmakers to increase transportation funding. We'll talk to a transportation expert involved in that effort.
First, there's talk of another possible government shutdown as an effort to reach a budget deal could be stalled over Planned Parenthood funding. This kind of budget news makes it into the headlines, but our next guest would like to see more talk about the bigger budget picture, the national debt, our annual deficit, and she wants to avoid what she says are some commonly held myths and misconceptions about budget issues.
The issue has not been front and center in the presidential race so far, leading to frustration even among some candidates. Here's Florida Senator Marco Rubio on ABC's This Week talking about the second Republican presidential debate.
We had a three-hour debate, no discussion about the national debt, very little about the economy. It was a constant he said, she said, what do you say because so-and-so called you this name or that name.
Maya McGinnis is head of the Campaign to Fix the Debt and president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which has a new report titled 16 Budget Myths to Watch Out for in the 2016 Campaign. Maya, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, nice to be with you.
So, Maya, Marco Rubio was frustrated by that debate. So were you. During the debate, you tweeted, "So the talk on necessary entitlement reforms is over already?" Are budget issues getting short shrift so far in this race?
Yeah, they absolutely are. First I should say I am and our organization is politically independent and we don't endorse candidates, but I would certainly endorse the comments of Marco Rubio, which was, we are not in these debates focusing on any of the real issues that really affect Americans' lives. There are so many economic challenges facing the country right now, and there are actually a lot of different kinds of ideas and solutions that the candidates are putting forth, but you would not know it from the kinds of questions that the moderators have been focusing on, where they're clearly, their intention is to try to get fights between the different candidates and, you know, get big sound bites that will make the news and be repeated over and over again, but it does nothing for the voters in terms of learning what the candidates really stand for, and it does nothing for fueling a national discussion about how are we going to tackle some of these big economic challenges, and certainly I would say what to do about the $18 trillion debt this country has is front and center of those issues we should be talking about.
While that debt continues to grow from year to year, the deficit, the annual shortfall that gets lumped onto that debt, has dropped really substantially, $1.4 trillion a year, as you say in your report, in 2009, now less than $500 billion last year. Do you think that takes some of the urgency out of this issue for people in the media, politicians, maybe the public?
Interestingly, I think it takes the urgency out for politicians and people who don't want to talk about it because I'll make a couple points. One, the short-term deficit has improved dramatically, and given that that's mainly been a sign of a recovering economy and to some extent some policy changes we've made, though I would say they weren't the right policies, but overall, that's a good thing. Two, I would say the short-term deficit never was and isn't the problem. The problem has always been the trajectory that we're on, the fact that we are slated to continue borrowing more and more every year, $7 trillion under the next president's term, assuming it's 8 years, if policy changes aren't made. And that's all due to growing health care costs and the aging of the population. So the real problem was never the deficit this year or the deficit next year, but the fact that we have a mountain of debt that we're facing, and it's only expected to grow larger. And then three, I would also point out, again, I'm not really worried about short-term deficits. The problem is the debt, but when did we decide that a $400 billion deficit was something to cheer about? And the fact is it's come down by two-thirds after it grew by 800%, and that was during the economic recession. And really the reason that so many politicians are talking about why the deficit has improved is dealing with these problems are hard. They require a lot of very difficult policy choices, revenue increases and spending cuts. And I'll say that again, revenue increases and spending cuts, because it's the opposite of what politicians talk about. They talk about cutting taxes and raising spending. And I know that's what everybody would like, and I know that's what politicians talk about, but those aren't the real solutions. And if we continue to do those things, and that leads to more borrowing, we're really going to harm the economy in a way that has profound effects on economic growth, on jobs, on wages, on our standard of living, and on the kind of economy we're leaving for the next generation, for our children. So there are big issues, there are tough solutions, but politicians do like to kind of avoid them whenever they can, and for that reason, they've been focusing on that improving deficit instead of that mountain of debt.
I'm talking to Maya McGinnis with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget about that organization's report, 16 Budget Myths to Watch Out For in the 2016 Campaign. You were just pretty much hitting myth number one there, that the idea that we can continue borrowing without consequences. So as that debt mounts, you're saying economic damage is going to come. Paint us a picture what that might look like.
Yeah, and I think it's important to do that, because I say, you know, as somebody who's been working on this issue and worries about it, it's very hard for people to understand why this actually matters to them. We all in our own lives have a whole lot of economic challenges that we're dealing with, you know, whether it's whether you've lost a job, whether your job's not making as much money as you need to get by, how to save for your retirement, how to save for your kids' college, the growing cost of health care costs. There are a whole lot of economic worries out there. And so adding another one of the deficit or debt, one isn't news people welcome, but it seems very removed from the immediate issues we're dealing with. But here's what happens. When the economy is kind of burdened by heavy debt levels, which we are right now, and I should say our debt is twice what it has been historically as a share of the economy. That is very high. It's as high as it was right after World War II, when we had a plan to bring it down. And when your debt levels are very high like that and absorbing a lot out of the economy, it slows economic growth. And so that means that the recovery that we've had, which has not been as good as one might have liked, and it's because we came out of a very tough economic recession. The 2008 sort of financial crisis was very serious. The recovery has been tough. But it's been hindered by the fact that our debt levels are so high. It dampens economic growth, and it makes people and markets very insecure. In many ways, I would say that debt actually reflects the dysfunction that you see in Washington. The debt is there, and deficits, the borrowing each year, aren't bad when the economy's sluggish. They make sense. But when it gets better, you should have a plan not to borrow so much. But the debt has been continuing to grow, and the deficits are still large, because we spend a lot of money, and we don't want to pay for it. And that is, in many ways, the result of the huge partisanship that goes on in Washington, right? The ongoing fights between Republicans and Democrats, where they're very, very unwilling to compromise, and the desire to make easy choices instead of hard choices. So instead of figuring out how to pay for things, cut spending or pay for what we want to spend, we just borrow. So it harms the economy. It will at some point, and we all don't know what's going to happen when the Fed raises rates, but at some point when interest rates go up, it will put a big amount of pressure on the budget, because the interest payments in the budget will also go up. And right now it's actually projected that interest payments in the budget will be the fastest growing part of the budget. So I don't care if you're, I don't care if you're the, you know, most arch conservative or most liberal progressive out there. Spending money on interest payments means no more tax cuts, no more spending increases. It's just sending money to pay for what we've already borrowed. So those growing interest payments also have a real dampening effect on the economy and the budget.
Getting back to some of the myths on your list, you've got some that will offend the arch-conservative and some that will offend the ultra-liberals.
Bipartisan offenders, yeah.
So one myth you say in this list, tax cuts pay for themselves.
Oh, that has just been going on forever. You hear it over and over again. And I have to say, while I would give Republicans credit for starting to talk about some of the policies, despite the moderator's attempts and the debates not to go there, but we've been seeing some policies coming out. But it's as though we're, I don't know what fiscal reality candidates are in right now when we're seeing a bunch of tax reform plans that would actually cut taxes by trillions of dollars, just at a time when we really need to be tackling this debt, getting it under control for the future, I mean, for our kids, if for no other reason. If we don't care about ourselves, don't we care about our kids? But we're now seeing plans that would cut taxes dramatically, and you hear many people in their talking points argue tax cuts pay for themselves. So let me kind of straighten that out. Tax cuts can help grow the economy. High tax rates on things that we want to do more of, work and save, for instance, it create an incentive for us to work less and save less. That doesn't help the economy. So you want to bring tax rates down whenever you can. But you can't actually bring them down so much that they help grow the economy to the point where they generate the amount of lost revenue. So if you cut taxes by a dollar, it will lose a dollar, and it may generate another 10 to 30 cents on that dollar, but they don't pay for themselves. We've seen study after study after study making it clear that they don't pay for themselves. And I'll just take the Bush tax reform plan that's been put out there, which I think structurally is a really interesting tax plan. There are a lot of very good ideas in there. But it's estimated by some of the folks even close to the Bush campaign that it would lose $3 to $3.5 trillion over 10 years. And they say that even if you scored it with economic growth, it would still lose $1.2 trillion. I think that's probably optimistic. I think it would probably lose more. But the point is, there are no tax cuts that are realistically over time going to pay for themselves. They can help grow the economy. Tax reform is a useful thing to do. But you also need to offset the cost of those tax cuts so they don't add to the debt. There are no free lunches.
One to maybe offend the other side now. We can solve the problem. This is on the list of myths. We can solve this problem, the deficit, the debt, by taxing the top 1% more.
This has really become a problem in the past campaigns because we've been hearing more and more about the top 1%. Now, on one hand, income inequality has grown tremendously in this country, and I certainly don't think that's desirable. I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think it's good for our form of economic capitalism when you're seeing more and more of the income and the wealth consolidated in not just the wealthy, the top 10% like it used to be as much, but even more the top 1% and the top 0.1%. So there is a real problem of growing income inequality. But there is not enough money that you can fix all of the problems just by taxing the uber wealthy. And so when you hear proposals on the left, you know, those big tax cuts I was talking about were on the right, you hear proposals on the left for a lot of new spending programs, and we've heard in past campaigns, and we're starting to in this campaign, you just tax the top 1% to pay for, you know, a whole menu of new spending programs. There's just not the money there to do that. So we have to be realistic that I do believe new revenues will have to be part of an overall solution. They should come from reforming the tax code in a way that promotes growth, but won't pay for itself. But it's not just going to be the top 1%. And if we perpetuate that myth when many people who are in the middle or the upper middle do have to have some higher revenues as well, they're going to have been kind of feel like they were sold a bill of goods. I thought Bill Gates was paying for everything. It's just not going to work that way because our problems, our fiscal hole is so deep, it's going to have to be broader reforms than that.
We're talking to Maya McGuinness with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, looking at the national debt, the presidential race. She says there are a lot of myths and misconceptions on both sides of the partisan divide.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the deficit should be a top priority in the presidential race? What do you think needs to change when it comes to federal taxes and spending? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. She's making the case that the national debt should be a top issue in the presidential race, and she's taking aim at what she calls myths about the budget.
You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you wish this were a bigger issue in the presidential race? What do you want to hear from the candidates? What do we need to do, do you think, to solve the national deficit, the debt? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We have linked there the 16 myths about the budget from our guest's organization. We'll go to our callers right away. We've got Jordan on the line in Green Bay. Jordan, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jordan?
I'm curious if your guest could explain to me better the correlation between the actual number of our national debt and that hindering the economy. Say if it were only $10 billion, how would tomorrow morning the economy be better from that? And I guess that's my only question. I'll take it off here.
Jordan, thanks. Maya?
Sure. Okay. So, well, if it were only $10 billion compared to the trillions that it is, that would be a massive change. But there is no set amount of where the debt levels, and we usually talk about it as a share of the economy, not as an overall number, because it's really relative to the economy that has the most effect on the performance of the economy. But if the debt were lower, it would not be absorbing the capital that you need for other investments. That has not been a problem recently because interest rates have been so low and there's such a surplus of investment capital throughout the economy, in many ways because of globalization, because we can borrow from all around the world. And despite our own economic challenges, we still look better than a lot of other economies. So we still get investment capital here. But when your debt is as high as ours are, there are two big worries that you have. One, and again, just to put in perspective, traditionally our debt has been, on average, below 40% of GDP. Right now, the debt owed to the public, which we've borrowed, that doesn't count what we owe to ourselves to pay Social Security, but the debt owed to the public as a share of the economy is above 70% of GDP, significantly higher. And what that means is that people know we're going to have to make changes down the road. We're going to have to change spending, or we're going to have to raise revenues, or most likely we're going to have to do both. The level of uncertainty of what it is that we're going to do creates real problems in the economy. It means that people don't know what the economic situation will be in the future, and that uncertainty kind of can freeze up the economy, keep people from investing nearly as much as they otherwise would. The other problem, which people have been talking about a lot more recently, and it's one that really concerns me, is when you have a recession or an emergency, there are two main tools that we use to help to counterbalance those problems. Monetary policy, which is what the Fed does, borrowing interest rates, and fiscal policy, which is when we borrow money, run larger surpluses to counterbalance the fact that there's not as much private consumption going on in the economy. That's what really helped us in 2008, I believe, keep that very significant recession from turning into a much bigger problem, perhaps a depression. We borrowed a lot of money at the federal government level. You can argue about whether the stimulus dollars were spent perfectly, but that money kept us from having a much worse economic downturn. At this point in the business cycle, nobody knows when the next recession will hit, but we're probably closer to the next downturn than we are the one that we already had. And if and when that happens, if our debt levels as a share of the economy are so much higher as they are now, it may be much more difficult to borrow to help counterbalance that. That's why you don't need to balance the budget every year. That's actually a much sort of stricter requirement than you need and would be counterproductive. What you want to do is figure out how you're going to balance the budget over a business cycle so you can borrow when times are tough and save when the economy is strong. And the problem is we borrow a lot when times are tough, and we don't save when good times are good. We don't pay back the money. We don't run budget surpluses. And that leaves us very vulnerable to the future. So sort of the vulnerability that we have combined with the uncertainty, which leads to lower investments throughout our economy, have an effect on the economy today. And all sorts of kind of the nonpartisan organizations I turn to and look at, but the IMF, Congressional Budget Office, they have looked at and studied our debt levels and are concerned that high levels of debt have negative effects on our growth.
Talking to Maya McGinnis from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget about debt and deficit in the presidential race. Our next caller is Josh in Eau Claire. Josh, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question, and I'll take my answer right off the air. Your guest had talked a little bit about the myths that both the left and the right present when it comes to tax cuts and tax increases. I'm wondering if she is familiar with a IRS replacement called the Fair Tax, and if so, everything I read about it seems to appear that it would generate a lot more revenue for the government and would help, you know, solve our debt crisis. Just wanted to know if she's familiar with that and what her thoughts on that would be. And thanks again for taking my call. I'll listen off the air.
Josh, thanks for the call. Changing what and how we tax, Maya.
Okay, there are a couple different versions of sort of bigger taxes that have gotten a lot of attention, and I don't know the details of which fair tax the caller is referring to, but I'll talk about sort of the broad parameters of ones I know. Where there's a lot of popularity in changing our tax code so that it will be simpler and oftentimes flatter and oftentimes tax consumption instead of income so that it wouldn't tax our savings. Those are all three different pieces of it. One, simplifying the tax code I think is very, very desirable. What I would do to simplify the tax code is look at all the tax expenditures or tax breaks we have. We actually have over $1 trillion in lost revenue a year in tax breaks. You can get rid of a whole lot of those, simplify the code, make it much fairer, and actually bring down tax rates, which would help grow the economy, and generate revenues, which would help close the deficit. So I'm very inclined to look at doing that. I think simplifying the tax code by collapsing the rates from the rates we have now to just a flat tax or one or two rates is less desirable to me because I think we need a progressive tax code right now. I think given the growing income inequality in this country, the tax code should certainly not be less progressive. The idea of increasing the burden on lower or middle income workers is really contrary to what the trends that we see are in the economy, in my opinion. So I wouldn't be inclined to make fewer tax rates. And then finally, there's a lot of talk about what if you didn't tax saving? And it's a very, that one's a tough one. Not taxing saving, just taxing what we spend instead of what we save, I think is very good for the economy to help promote saving. We could really increase our individual saving rates in this country with a lot of benefit. But again, those who are well off have more money to save, so it ends up giving larger tax breaks to people at the top at a time when I think people in the lower end really need some tax relief compared to people at the upper end. The only other thing that I would say about some of the fair tax type plans that I've seen is they're often sold with very low rates. I've seen arguments about certain taxes, oh, we could just tax, replace all our income taxes with a 15% tax. Those numbers are generally wrong. They make a lot of mistakes. For instance, they look at the whole economy and assume you'd be taxing everything the government spends. But, of course, the government doesn't actually pay taxes. So when you net out more realistic numbers, the rates tend to be a lot higher than people first realize, and that gets rid of some of the desirability.
And Maya, we just have a minute to wrap up, and I wanted to ask about the politics briefly, their constituencies for tax cuts and for spending increases. What would it take to get the politics here to have a real deficit reduction and debt reduction package?
Well, I think it's definitely going to take leadership. It's going to take political leadership from the top, and that's why I think this 2016 campaign is absolutely critical. If we have a campaign where the candidates talk about all the giveaways that they would give, it's going to sound great to all of us. You know, I would love tax cuts. I would love brand new programs. But if that's what we talk about, whoever wins for president is not going to be in a position to lead us into making some of the choices that we really need to make. So I think it's critical that, and that's why I think these debates matter, but that we have a national discussion on some of the choices. I think people would actually relish a candidate talking a little bit more directly. Social Security, we haven't talked about that, but that's a real hot button. We would get a lot of upset calls if I started talking about how we do need to reform Social Security, which we do. But I think if somebody were able to talk very practically and kind of reassuringly, we're not going to cut benefits for people over 55, but we need to look at how to reform those for people who are younger. If we had a discussion as a country, we could come to some real ideas about how we're going to make these changes, and that would allow our political leaders to move forward on them. The final component, I think, is this is not a one-party issue. I think the partisanship that we see in Washington is really wrecking this country.
Maya, thanks for joining us. That was Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We've got a 16 budget myths report linked on the Central Time Facebook page.